What's up, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mr. Movie. I'm your host, as always, Josh Bergman, and today I have my co-host, Jeff Bergman. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm effing great, Mr. Movie. In honor of our topic today, I think I might have to curse a little bit.
That is A-okay, because today we're going to be discussing the brand new film, The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, and in addition to that, we're going to be ranking our top seven Samuel O. Jackson roles, the man, the myth, the legend, SLJ. He is an icon. We love him so much, and I'm happy to do an episode dedicated entirely for him. But before we get into any of that, Dad, there's been some news that's been happening around since you've been gone.
Do tell.
Well, there's one movie that we've talked about, In the Heights, that was going to be a very big movie that ended up falling flat on its face in a special segment of some box office numbers, because I think this is a very weird, unique case for In the Heights, because even earlier this week or late last week, we saw a commercial for In the Heights, and you said, what happened to In the Heights? Because pretty much as of this recording, it's been 3 weekends since In the Heights came out, and really, there's not been that much talk about it. In the box office financial terms, it kind of just faded away. So let's get into it. So In the Heights, which came out the weekend of June 11th, it was estimated to gross around $25 to $30 million in its three-day opening weekend. Now, let's not forget that this film was originally going to come out in June of 2020. And then because of COVID, was pushed back to June of 2021, an entire year. And in its three-day opening weekend, what was to be estimated at $25 to $30 million in predictions, In the Heights grossed $11.5 million, way under not just expectations, but really the lowest of low for expectations. This came in way under what people were predicting, and that wasn't even just for the three-day. It technically opened up on the Thursday, so in the first 4 days, it grossed $11.5 million. Now, how did this happen? We're not too sure if there's one specific reason. One thing a lot of people may say is, oh, it's on HBO Max. Everyone just probably watched it on HBO Max because it's too long of a movie, or whatever you want to say. Well, due to our number one streaming friend, Samba Numbers, which records TVs watching streaming services, it reported that in its opening weekend, In the Heights had 693,000 viewers watching on HBO Max. Now, for some comparison, films like The Conjuring, Godzilla vs. Kong, Mortal Kombat, which also premiered on HBO Max, earned 1.6 to 3.8 million in its opening weekend. So not only in the box office, this earned lower than expected. On HBO Max, not that many people watched it. And the next couple weeks, in its second weekend, it dropped 63% to $4.2 million. And in its third weekend, it dropped another 47% to $2.2 million for a 3 weekend total of $24.1 million. That is less than what people thought it would make in just 3 days. What's your thoughts on what's happening, or what did happen and not happened within the Heights?
Well, I mean, sort of the first I'm hearing about it, so I will take a guess. My guess is that some of the, you know, most of the previews kind of allayed the fact that it was going to be sort of a maybe had some protesting or type of scene, you know, there was like a serious matter involving, you know, immigration and things like that. And maybe that turned off a section of the population that likes, like, you know what, I'm done with this theme. I've dealt with it all last year. I don't want to deal with it this year. Maybe that's it.
Well, it was also interesting because as we talked about in an episode, this felt like a lot of Latino representation. This is really going for the Latino crowd. They didn't really show up. On my notes, I currently don't have the exact number, but Fast and Furious 9, which also came out this weekend, had the highest population was Latino. Of course, for In the Heights, the highest population.
How do they know that?
For on the Friday nights of when these movies come out in theaters, they do a theater report for audiences coming out of the theater. And so they report the letter grade they give it. That's why you may say it gets an A cinema score. This is cinema score. They'd ask her age. So it could say that 50% of the audience was between 18 to 24. And you have your gender and your demographic of ethnicity. So it was reported that there wasn't as much Latino representation actually going to the theaters in the audience. Other elements may just be that the cast, like Lin-Manuel Miranda's name's attached. Maybe his name's just not as big as we all thought. Hamilton's big, but no one really knows of In the Heights. Even we knew Hamilton for several years, and we didn't really know that much about In the Heights until the movie came out. And if we didn't know that, who are pretty involved in the musical theater world and the film world, then the general audience wouldn't really know that much about In the Heights.
I think the other thing, you know, with musicals, you know, I think usually there's a large female population that attend, you know, Mamma Mia and Dreamgirls and Chicago. And I think those musicals were very successful because they were female driven. And I think wasn't as much. And so maybe the women didn't show up. And if the women aren't going to show up to musicals, then maybe the numbers aren't going to be there.
That might be a case because if we think of the last couple big musicals that came out, Mary Poppins Returns. You got Mary Poppins, Emily Blunt. Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. It's Mamma Mia. Greatest Showman. It only really has Zendaya as the biggest female character or most popular.
Yeah.
But also has Zac Efron.
And Hugh Jackman.
And Hugh Jackman, who can attract, who have male audience and also female audience. And also one thing to point out is that shows, movies like The Greatest Showman, had a song that came out for the radio. A lot of people listened to it. What song are people really listening to who haven't even seen the movie that are thinking, oh, that's the In the Heights song? No songs broke out. So that might also be a case. This is a musical with good music, just none of it broke out into the zeitgeist or pop radio. Another thing that happened was in its opening weekend, which I didn't even notice or find out about until the Sunday, was that there was a big backlash due to the lack of accurate Afro-Latino population in the movie, and there was an uproar about this, even though the cast has been known for years. I don't know why it's just coming out now, but then it even happened that Lin-Manuel had to apologize because of it, even though he wasn't involved in casting. But that's just the type of situation it was. So after a disappointing weekend and that backlash, it may just been that no one really cared about it after it came out. Also, one last point I want to make is that I haven't heard this anywhere, but through my experience, there were a lot of screenings for this movie before it came out. We got a screening in April. I found out about that screening because of another digital screening. There were a lot of college screenings that happened. Mother's Day, there was a nationwide Dolby Cinema screening in all AMC, Cinemarks, and Regals, and the Sunday before it came out, there was another free screening nationwide in AMCs and Regals. It's not the most accurate, but everyone who would have wanted to see this movie could have just gone on those free days, and then they didn't want to see it again. There's no real truth behind that. It's just my own opinion.
That is an interesting strategy that obviously failed.
And sadly, now what was once a Best Picture frontrunner, people were saying this in the week of release, everyone's pretty much forgot about it, sadly.
It'll still get nominations.
That's what you think. We'll say that.
Some nominations, but, you know, I mean, it still might get nominated for Best Picture.
Well, let's go into that right now because award season is always happening. And we have another story to go about for the award season because just this week it was announced that the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, they have their own award show. And what they announced is that for their films, for a film to be nominated for the DGA for this upcoming award show, starting June 15th, the film has to have an exclusive theatrical run. And if it's not exclusive, then it can't be nominated. Therefore, a film like Dune, which is Warner Brothers and HBO Max, directed by Denis Villeneuve, who could get a nomination, does not qualify for the DGA because it will be on in theaters and on HBO Max at the same time. So every film from March to June 15th, they're good. Godzilla vs. Kong, that can get nominated. But In the Heights, technically, can still get nominated. But film like Dune, I'm blanking right now on the big
How long does the exclusive period have to be?
Has to be 7 days. So just 1 week. Warner Brothers can release Dune in theaters for 1 week only exclusively and go directly into HBO Max. It can qualify, but other films like The Many Saints of Newark potentially could get nominated. Well, now it can't because it's the HBO Max deal. So it's very interesting of how it really plays out because the Oscars, right after this announcement, said that we don't have this rule. If you're in theaters, if you're not in theaters, that's okay for the period of March 1st, 2021 to December 31st of 2021. And that's the award season. What do you think? Should the Oscars go on this exclusivity or is the DGA just have a stick up their butt?
Well, I think the DGA, you know, you're talking about real film people. And so I would think that's why they're doing it. And the Oscars, they don't really care. They just want, like, the most, they want any possible film that people are going to really like and tune in to the Oscars to be available. So
that's true, because they need people to
After what
tune
happened
in.
Last year, they need an audience.
Well, we have, what's it now, 6 months to see how this all unravels.
It's a short season.
It's a short season. I was surprised that they wouldn't go to January, like one extra month and do a, because this last year was February was the end. Next year it could be January, then go back to December. They're just 10 months.
There'll be enough movies coming out.
Well, speaking of Oscar potential movies, let's go into the movie of the week, because this week we're going to be talking about The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. This one is once again directed by Patrick Hughes, who directed the surprise first film, The Hitman's Bodyguard, in August of 2017, and it once again stars Ryan Reynolds as the bodyguard, Samuel Jackson is the hitman, and following the events of the first film, Ryan Reynolds, he now needs to take a break from bodyguarding. He goes on vacation and quickly gets pulled back into the bodyguard game by having to, in a way, help Selma Hayek, who was a cameo in the first film of being Samuel Jackson's wife. Now she has a bigger role by even being in the title of the movie. And then the three of them kind of get in wrapped up in a situation in which they have to save Europe from Antonio Banderas, who's the bad guy in this movie.
He's playing a Greek guy,
even though he doesn't have a Greek accent in the film. And really, it's just a bunch of espionage, spy, action, comedy, and this was a somewhat victim to the COVID-19 pandemic. It was originally going to come out in August of 2020. It wasn't even marketed before the shutdown, but because of COVID, it was then pushed back to August of 2021, and then in a, what I think was a smart marketing move, moved it up to Father's Day weekend of June 2021. Now, Dad, what's your opinion on The Hitman's Bodyguard, the first one? What were you thinking of going into this movie, and what'd you think coming out of The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard?
Well, you know, The Hitman's Bodyguard was, I think, was in one of my top action movies.
It was our first ever episode.
So I really was surprised by it when it came out, especially it was an August release, so you always get worried about August releases. But it was, you know, has two, I really like Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson. So right then and there, and Ryan Reynolds was doing his snarky, funny comedy self, and Samuel L. Jackson was doing his self. And so it's not like they're like stretching their acting abilities in the first movie. I thought this movie was just maybe a little over the top. It was kind of like maybe a little silly. I mean, a little unbelievable, you know, because I think there are a lot of scenes where like Salma Hayek and Ryan Reynolds, and they would have definitely should have gotten killed a few times during this movie.
Ryan Reynolds, I think they joke that he dies. Like, he actually dies three times in this movie and comes back to life.
I know.
And yeah, it's sometimes it can be a bit unbelievable.
Yeah, so I think, but I mean, if you like shoot 'em up, fun, you know, action movies that, you know, are an hour and 40 minutes, or, you know, this is like the perfect movie for you.
Yeah, I would say kind of we saw this together opening night, the first movie back in August, and we were pleasantly surprised. It's Samuel Jackson and Ryan Reynolds in a funny movie that had nice action in it, and I thought that was enjoyable. And then what I felt that came about was probably late 2019, early 2020, early COVID, was that on TV, on USA, on TNT, on Sci-Fi, on A&E, this movie played on four different channels all the time, daily. And so my roommate, who loves the first movie, would watch it a lot, and therefore I watch it a lot. And I saw the seatbelt rule happen a lot of times in the beginning of COVID. And so I don't know if it actually has a bigger following post a theatrical release, like a John Wick style, but I do think that this does hit, the first one hit a lot of good marks. If you got the cast, you got light comedy, light action, it's a fun time. And the second one came out of nowhere, I felt like. The trailer came out like 2 months ago, a great mashup with Britney Spears' Hit Me Baby One More Time and just the comedy of this movie, and I thought, this seems great. And then the movie happened, and the first 40 minutes of the movie, when we're trying to get back into the world and the characters, it felt very off. Even like the therapist scene with Ryan Reynolds, I thought the comedy's not landing. Selma Hayek gets introduced, and I feel like one of the major characteristics of Selma Hayek's character was she is loud, and she curses a lot, and sometimes she speaks in Spanish. There was so much loudness of not just sound effects. Everyone yells, especially when they enter Samuel Jackson and Ryan Reynolds, where I felt like a lot of the jokes were just them yelling at each other, them cursing at each other. And for me, it didn't really work that well until there is one specific scene. And if you want to know nothing, skip ahead to whatever time code, but he's on the poster. He's on the main title cards. Morgan Freeman is in this movie. And I'm not going to say what he does in the movie, but his scene, I thought, was a turning point, because not only did I think his introduction and his reasoning for him being in the movie was funny, something with the comedy in that scene and the style of editing and the pacing, that no one was yelling, there was no quick editing, and from the movie forward, I thought that it worked a lot better than the first 40 minutes. The comedy was stronger. There's one scene with Ryan Reynolds at a bar, and he's like, I want to do crazy stuff again. And a guy lands on the bar. He takes a bottle and hits the guy in the head, and he just falls off. Me saying it, it doesn't sound funny. But the way that it's shot and not edited, because it's all a single take, I thought, like, that's the type of comedy of slapstick I like, what I liked in the first film, and what I thought a lot of what was missing in the first half of this movie. Because as you were saying, there was some stuff in the first half of Ryan Reynolds being thrown around in a car, being locked in a trunk for, what, a day, and coming out alive. Like, not only was it unbelievable, it just wasn't funny. So this is the weirdest bag for me, in which I really was uncomfortable the first half, and I had a pleasant time the second half. Did you feel like there was an inconsistency, or was it all just the same for you?
No, now that I'm thinking about what you're saying, I kind of agree. I mean, yes, the introduction of Morgan Freeman's character was funny, and it did change the plot of the movie, and I guess it was a little twist to it. But I agree.
Did you think that just the movie was funny, besides the Morgan Freeman stuff, like with Samuel Jackson doing his Samuel Jackson stick, Ryan Reynolds doing his Ryan Reynolds stick, did you think, like, this was funny, or did you think that they were trying too hard?
I thought they were trying too hard.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was saying. It felt like, it was a real sequel, you know? Like, you know, where sequels, like, where it's a sequel where they just want to make the money, and they don't really, like, try hard enough on the script, you know, and the dialogue. And
they think that, oh, we have Samuel Jackson back. He can do his thing. Ryan Reynolds can do his thing. Salma Hayek can do their thing without any effort. And because of that, you get at least what I thought was a lackluster first half. And I don't know if something happened, because they probably edited a majority of this in COVID and did all of the visual effects in COVID, which, I mean, not all the visual effects look great. I thought that is obviously a fake fire or obvious green screen background when they're standing on a ledge. There was one element in this movie that I didn't know he was going to be in it going in. Frank Grillo, who I think is like a big B-list action star. I hated Frank Grillo's story. His character, because when he's first introduced, he's like a CIA guy who brings the three into, you're going to do this thing. He was just cursing and making rude remarks without any wit to him. And I think that's what the movie thought was funny. And every time he even came on screen, the movie slowed down and he was gone for like an hour. And I was so happy. And he came back during the climax and I rolled my eyes and I went, oh crap. What'd you think of Frank Grillo?
He's like a one note guy. I mean, he has no range or acting. I mean, they could have, I don't know why they cast an American. They could have casted like a foreign person, because it was a European police unit.
That's
so they
true.
Could have casted like a tough but funny type of foreign actor. I don't know.
I'm even thinking that it's Frank Grillo, a good action star. I don't think he did anything action in the movie.
Like, you know, would have been good in that role, like Simon Pegg, or
that would have been great. But no, we got a dull, not funny Frank Grillo. So as I said, this movie was supposed to come out in August of 2020, and it was delayed 10 months. Do you think the movie was worth the wait? I know we didn't get any promotional material before it got delayed, but do you think, like, yes, it deserved the wait of COVID, or it should have come out during the pandemic?
I think it's the type of movie you'd like to see in a theater.
So going to the next question, you think that this should have been seen in theaters?
Yeah, any big action movie is always better in a theater.
I was thinking the same. Looking at the cast, watching the movie, I'm like, I love seeing these people on screen. But then in the first 40 minutes, I thought this felt like a V, like something on Netflix,
right,
or something you find on a plane, action movie. but with good stars in it. Yeah. And that's how it made it to the theater. And I thought that that, in a sense, was a bit disappointing until we get to the second half, which I did like much more. But even in theaters, do I think this was worth in theaters? I think if the movie was just overall better, then it would be worth in theaters. I don't think this isn't a, is it worth it in theaters? Do I just think it's worth it overall? And I'm not too sure if overall the movie is worth it. Well, one thing we didn't even talk about before we go further, the action. It is an action movie. It was one of, the first one was one of your top action movies. How was the action?
I got to think back at this. I don't think the action was anything special that I haven't seen in any Marvel movie. I don't remember like a scene. I mean, the Fast F9 movies are probably have better action scenes than this had.
I would say,
yes. There was a lot of shooting, guns, people getting killed. The count was very high.
There was a big body count in this film.
Big body count. But I don't think from an action standpoint, it was so innovative.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I remember there was a bar, or a club fight scene early on where Salma Hayek's in disguise. And they do it as a one shot where it looks like it's all in one take. But there's a lot of shaky cam, and I personally couldn't really follow that well of what was happening in the scene. I know there's a good driving scene that is a nice fake-out gag that I thought was hysterical, but it didn't really go the full extent, and I'm trying to think of an action scene.
That's memorable. I mean, like when you see stuff from Tenet, or you see stuff from F9, or the other Fast and the Furious movies.
I can identify the magnet scene in Fast 9, or the bridge scene in Fast 9, but there's a boat scene, but that's just because I'm really thinking hard of, like, stuff happened on the boat, which is the climax of the movie. But yeah, I guess overall the action was suitable.
Yes.
But then to go on, who or what would you say was the star of the movie? The one thing you can take away saying this was great.
I guess you're right. Maybe Morgan Freeman. yeah, I mean, I think Ryan Reynolds kind of mailed it in. I think Samuel L. Jackson was good. Salma Hayek had a big role, but I wouldn't say she was like the most memorable thing about it. Probably just the interaction between the two stars. I think that's what was good about the first movie.
And it was good about this one.
Yeah.
I would say for me, it's Morgan Freeman. It's God himself. Because not only did I think that he and his role was funny in the film, but his scene, his introduction, was a pivotal point, a changing point in the film where I was actually enjoying myself for the last 45 minutes. And our final question, how would you rank this on the nut scale? Would you give this an almond, lowest of the low, walnut, low to mixed, cashew, mix of positive, or the almighty peanut?
Well, it was a good time in the theater, so you would think cashew, but I would go walnut. It's, you know, it just lost the quality.
I would also give this a walnut. If you said it in the first 40 minutes, Josh, what'd you think? I'd say, I hate to say it, it's an almond, but I do think something picked up in the last 50 minutes where it does warrant a walnut for me. And sadly, that's the Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. How would you think? Would you want more? Would you want a third one?
Sure.
Yeah?
Well, yeah. What's a better director? Give me, like, you know.
So you want change the style because he was the first two directors.
Or a better screenwriter. Or, you know, or you can introduce new, funner, you know, characters and things.
What would be your hook? Because this one, it adds his wife as, like, she's on the team. What would you do for the third one?
Well, obviously, Ryan Reynolds would have to have a romantic interest.
Yeah. And that would be left alone.
And then it would be a foursome.
I have an idea. Because a big...
Maybe his own wife would do it. She's like, you know...
Blake Lively?
Yeah.
That would be fun.
You know?
I could like her as a good cameo. Maybe one that she's trying to fall in love with Ryan Reynolds, but is actually a spy and beats him up. That would be fun.
That would be fun.
My idea, in reality, I don't think there really should be a third one. But if you are, make a third one. Because a big part of this movie is the Salma Hayek wants a kid. And I'm not going to say what happens by the end of the movie with this storyline. But make something happen for the third where the title would be The Hitman's Wife's Child's Bodyguard. Keep on adding. And you could change it to either son or daughter if you get like a great young actress who can be vulgar and badass like Samuel L. Jackson. I think something, an idea like that, could make this film, the third one potentially, a bit more fun.
Well, you know, it's got the right key demographics. You know, you got Samuel L. Jackson, and he has a lot of fans, and you have this movie had Antonio Banderas and Selma Hayek, and they have a lot of fans, and they had Ryan Reynolds. He has a lot of fans. So from a demographic standpoint, already you're going to get a good base of people going.
I do wonder if this film had a higher Latino population than In the Heights.
Do we have a box office?
We do have some box office numbers. You jumped the gun. I was just going to get to it. So, The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, which came out on Father's Day weekend, which I once again think was very appropriate. In its three-day weekend, it grossed $11.4 million. Now, this isn't the best number out of any movie. It did gross first place of the weekend, but this is an asterisk because it technically opened up on the Wednesday. So in the five-day opening weekend, it did gross $16.7 million, which is not that bad if you compare it to the first movie, in which its three-day was $21 million, which only $5 million less by its first Sunday. Now, without COVID, how well would this movie have done? We'll never know. Probably there would have been a drop very similar to this, so maybe having it in the beginning of theaters reopening for summer, it probably was good for this movie. In its second weekend, it did drop 57% to $4.8 million, which made sense because of lack of Father's Day and Fast and Furious 9. And currently, it is totaled at $27.6 million domestically. Worldwide, it is at $41 million, and it is against a $70 million budget. So once again, it's not making gangbusters money, but it is a sequel that's not getting the best word of mouth. So this might just be an average result. It may end around $70 million for its budget. It may.
Who made this movie?
This was Lionsgate.
Lionsgate.
Yes.
So what's going to happen is now they'll probably put it out in a bidding war, and then like all the different, since Lionsgate isn't owned by anybody.
Lionsgate, it's either Lionsgate owns Stars or the other way around. They're related to Stars.
I see. So it would go to Stars.
It might also go to HBO because I don't know. I always forget the exact contracts, but I know the first Hitman's Bodyguard, which is the same distributor, went to HBO. So I know that Lionsgate said we are sending our films to Stars, but this might be the extra one out that is going to HBO.
So it's
going
to go to HBO Max.
It's going to one of the streaming services, right? Stars or HBO, and then it's probably going to go, like its first one, to TNT, to USA, and play a lot because it does feel like a good Sunday or Saturday cable movie. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, listen, it'll eventually probably make money.
I mean, the first one ended up grossing $73 million domestically, so by the end of this run, hopefully the drops will level out and it will probably end up at this number, maybe with around 39, 40 million, a little bit more than half of the first movie. So, I mean, it's not the worst case scenario. It could have done so much worse, but sadly, it could have done a lot better.
I think, but the lesson is, it's taking longer for the movie business to come back than we thought.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Fast 9 numbers were, because we're now recording this on July 1st.
Yeah, well, Fast and Furious, it opened to $70 million domestically, which has been the highest opening weekend since Rise of Skywalker. It was higher than Bad Boys for Life in a normal 2020 world. It actually did better than some expectations. It's doing decent for Fast and Furious.
Compared to the last Fast and Furious movie?
Compared to the last Fast and Furious, not Hobbs and Shaw, the last one, Fate of the Furious, which opened up Easter weekend in 2017, grossed $98 million.
Oh.
So a drop off of 28.
That's not bad.
With COVID, yeah, it's not that bad. So movie theaters, they are slowly getting back up, and Black Widow's just around the corner. Sadly, Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard is not making a notable dent in the box office. But because this movie does star the one and only Samuel L. Jackson, I thought this was an appropriate time to dedicate an episode to this man. He is an icon. He has been in so many movies, and I thought this would be a great time to do a list of our top 7 Samuel L. Jackson roles. How was this, getting lists together for you?
It was pretty easy. You know, I mean, because, you know, he definitely has a lot of movies people know about. But I think overall, what I like about Samuel L. Jackson is that I feel that even though he doesn't really, let's say, his personas in all these movies aren't that much different, but you always feel like he's, like, real. You know, like some actors feel fake. Samuel L. Jackson just feels real.
Like Bruce Willis sometimes, especially later, feels fake.
Yes.
Like he doesn't care.
Yeah, I think he's aged very well, Samuel L. Jackson.
He hasn't gotten, you mean physically?
I think physically. I think he hasn't had like any plastic surgery, at least I don't know about. But I just feel like he's still tough, you know? And
I mean, I'd say the same, because growing up, like, seeing him in earlier roles, I think, this man's old, because, like, he's bald, too. Yeah. And so I probably put him at, like, 65 to 70, and now it's 15 years later, and he is now 70, early 70s, and he looks great. He has found the fountain of youth. I don't know how,
yeah.
But he's aged.
Hollywood
he's
for
ageless.
You.
But yeah, in similar stance, I love Samuel Jackson. There are some iconic, definitive roles for him. And yeah, sometimes he does play Samuel Jackson, but at least from memory, I can't really recall a film that he's phoned in. He always seems like he is there, whether it may just be himself. And I enjoy it, at least mostly. I can't really think of a bad role that I didn't like him in. Did you have any rules for your list?
Well, obviously, after the fact, you told me that this was based his top roles versus the top movies that he was in. So, no, I just like, for instance, I felt like the role had to be significant enough. In other words, the scene in Coming to America where he plays a robber in the fast food store, that was too short, too small, doesn't qualify. Even though the movie was good, I went with he had to have a significant role in the movie.
There's one maybe exception of significant role, what you may want to say, but one rule that I didn't tell you about that I kind of followed for myself was I only chose one Quentin.
No, I did not follow that.
That is okay.
But I only chose, you know, the whole, well, we'll get to it.
All right then, Dad, what is your number 7 Samuel Jackson role?
I'm going to say the number 7 role is his role as the villain in The Kingsman, the first Kingsman movie.
Yeah.
The Kingsman was Secret Service. Secret Service.
Valentine. I remember his name's Valentine.
Yeah. And so people can argue about his lisp in the movie and whether it was good, bad.
Necessary.
Necessary. Like, what was the reason for the lisp? Have you ever read anything about that?
I don't know. I actually have never read anything about it. Maybe it could be, because you know it's based on James Bond, and some James Bond, Blofeld, has a mark on his eye. Mm-hmm. They wanted some, in a sense, deformity, one may say. So they didn't want to do anything physical, so they gave him a lisp.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Well, I like the fact that he was, you know, it's one of the few movies I have on the list here where he was really the villain, and I like that. So I'm going with The Kingsman, number 7.
When you brought up some may like the lisp and some may don't, I thought about this for my list, and I thought, why did he have a lisp? And I don't, it's not, I don't have a thing against people with lisps, but knowing Samuel Jackson and what he can do and how he says stuff, it made it a bit laughable for me, even though I love him in the role and I love Kingsman. Sadly, it didn't make my list because he has a lisp. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Up for me at number 7, we got, I guess you could say, is a smaller role for him. It is his role of Ray Arnold in Jurassic Park. I'm a huge fan of the movie itself, Jurassic Park, and I've surprisingly, after 40 episodes now, have never put it on any list, so I thought, why not now? He works on the island of Jurassic Park. He's there when everything goes wrong, and he says the famous line, "Hold on to your butts," and he does it while smoking a cigarette, and he looks cool. What could I say? And of course, he has a great off-screen death scene, but it's a good fake out because you think he's alive and it's his arm, but really it's not, and she freaks out. I love that scene. And when Newman is on the computer saying "nuh-uh-uh," Samuel Jackson goes, "Please," and I love that so much. Movie is pretty good too. I love it. Including a 3D re-release, Jurassic Park earned $402 million domestically and $1.045 billion worldwide. So my number 7, Ray Arnold in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, unfortunately, he got the African-American treatment in horror films, you know?
He was one of the early people to die, sadly.
Yeah, no, listen, he was good in that, and then unfortunately, they killed him.
I think most people forget, like, oh yeah, Samuel Jackson's in that movie.
I had forgotten when you brought it up.
Exactly.
All right, so my number 6 movie, I'm going to go with Unbreakable, the first one.
Yeah.
The first version, the first M. Night Shyamalan movie.
In that trilogy universe.
Right. So I'm going to go with Unbreakable, which is like right after The Sixth Sense, and, you know, obviously didn't do as well as Sixth Sense, but it was a kind of a strange, different type of movie. You kind of weren't sure where it was going for a while, but I like his character in it. I think he made the movie, so I'm going to go with that. Number 6.
Mr. Glass. It's funny, because I've seen Split, and then at the end of Split, Bruce Willis shows up, and my friend's like, oh my god, it's him, and I'm like, who is it? Because I've never seen Unbreakable. And even with that, I saw Glass 2 years later, which brings back Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson as Mr. Glass, and I still haven't seen Unbreakable. I know a lot about it and how it was kind of, in a way, ahead of its time of the superhero genre, which, looking back 20 years later, pretty cool. I said this before, it's on my list. I just never gotten around to watch Unbreakable, even though I do know a lot of what happens, especially now with the two sequels.
Right, and I thought I'd put it on the list this way. I don't think you would pick it, so.
Good choice, even though I haven't seen it. Up for me, then, at number 6 is the movie that pretty much this episode is following, and it is The Hitman's Bodyguard. Samuel Jackson plays Darius Kincaid. I love it. He is a vulgar, vicious hitman who is awesome, shooting things and people. Samuel Jackson in this one, as we kind of said, he plays Samuel Jackson. But I think in this one, he does it well. This feels like the most just Samuel Jackson role out of his most recent stuff. He curses. He laughs like Samuel Jackson. It's great. And he has good banter with Ryan Reynolds. He's just pretty badass, especially with the end when there's an explosion behind him and he just looks cool standing over Gary Oldman. Can't really complain that much about it. Hitman's Bodyguard grossed $72.4 million domestically and $183 million worldwide. My number 6, Darius Kincaid in The Hitman's Bodyguard.
I was going to put it on my list, but then I felt, well, one, I've already used it before, but two, you know, we just talked about it throughout this episode, so...
Yeah.
I wouldn't have to.
I thought it was like a dedication.
Right.
We talked about it for the entire episode. Of course, let's put it on the list. But I understand.
Listen, really enjoyable movie. If you haven't seen the first one, see it before you see this one.
It's probably on cable.
Yes, somewhere.
All right, what do you have next for number 5?
My number 5 is Django Unchained, where Samuel Jackson plays the, I guess, servant for Leonardo DiCaprio. What was the name of the house again?
Candyland.
And so... You know, he sort of has a bit of a limp through the movie. He kind of runs the house for Leonardo DiCaprio. And till the end, when he kind of reveals his true self, which I thought was really cool. But, you know, it was interesting to see him play someone who was feeble or handicapped and having to do that type of role. And, you know, it was kind of weird seeing him being in that, you know, traditional massa subservient type of role when you know that's not him. And because he wasn't really the star of the movie and it was a smaller part, I put it a little bit farther down on the list. So that's my number 5.
Nice.
Django.
I love Django Unchained. We've talked about it before on the show. Samuel Jackson's great in that. I'm going to hold off because I'll probably talk about it a bit later. Up for me at number 5, I got a film. I'm not sure if you saw this one, but it is Deep Blue Sea. This is the shark movie with Samuel Jackson, who plays Russell Franklin. This movie is about a bunch of scientists in an underwater facility, and they're sharks. No one really remembers much about this movie, except there is the famous scene where Samuel Jackson is giving an inspirational speech, and in the middle of the speech, a shark jumps up and eats him and kills him. It's one of the famous unexpected death scenes. It's really all that I remember from this movie, and because of how memorable it is, I had to put it on this list. It's very sudden. I love it. $73.6 million domestically, $165 million worldwide. My number 5, Deep Blue Sea.
I have not seen it.
I don't remember really
anything
else about it.
But again, why does he get killed again? I don't understand.
It's Samuel Jackson. He has a great way of going out. I feel like there are more films on this list where he dies in a sense.
Okay.
He's great at it.
You know, after Jaws, I just felt like I really don't need to see another shark movie except for The Meg, which I thought was interesting
because it was
a giant thing and that was kind of funny. So I really have no interest in seeing shark movies.
This movie, once again, it doesn't reinvent the genre. It's not that memorable, except for this one scene where if you don't know what's going to happen, it can be very fun and surprising.
All right. So my number 4, and again, this is an amalgamation. You could choose whichever movie you want in the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
Some people like Captain Marvel. I'm going to go with The Avengers because I feel it's the first movie where he's really a principal player in the Marvel world, where he's bringing all of the various Avengers together for the first time, and where you really see himself and his team, part of S.H.I.E.L.D. And so even, you know, it's hard to say which Avengers movie, which Marvel movie is acting the best in. It's hard to say whether it's Spider-Man. Maybe it could be Spider-Man, one of the Spider-Man movies, you know, Far From Home,
mm-hmm.
or Captain Marvel. I mean, he really...
Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier, yeah. So, but I'm going to go with the Avengers since it was really the first one where he was like a principal character.
Good pick. I mean, of course, Nick Fury was going to pop up on both of our lists. He's going to come up shortly, so we'll get to him soon and which film I chose him in for the definitive Nick Fury role. But for me, at number four, I got a film that I just love in my heart, and it is Kong Skull Island.
I know you were going to add Kong Skull Island.
You know,
there.
Samuel Jackson plays Lieutenant Colonel Preston Packard, and I think that this is one of the most, maybe not of Samuel Jackson's roles, but in the film of Kong Skull Island, it is the character with the most depth in it, because the thing about Kong Skull Island is that it takes place in the 1970s, specifically right after the Vietnam War. And Samuel Jackson's character, he was a lieutenant or a colonel, I don't really know rankings. He was in the Vietnam War and he is so pissed that he lost. He was really mad, and so he puts all of his hatred and his potential victory of trying to take over either a land, civilization, or people into him trying to take over Skull Island and trying to destroy or kill Kong. And I love that dynamic and that aspect. It's not needed for the movie, but it makes the movie, and especially his character, who we already like because he's Samuel Jackson, but because of this motivation, it makes his character so much more interesting. And, I mean, spoilers if you haven't seen the four-year-old movie, he dies in the movie, just like all Samuel Jackson. How does he die? Kong says, screw you, as he sang his motherfucker. Kong crushes him with his fist. Great way to go out. God bless Samuel Jackson. $168 million domestically, $561 million worldwide. My number four, Kong Skull Island.
You know, I think I only have one movie where he dies, I think.
Oh, so. Was it Django?
Oh, Django. He died in Django, too. So I have two movies. He died in Kingsman.
Oh, yeah, and he dies in Kingsman.
And he died in Django.
Let's see, how many...
Oh, and he probably dies, well, in another one that I chose.
We'll go on to that later. But before we get to that, Dad, we're actually halfway through our list now. So we're going to be taking a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor, Anchor, and then we're going to get right back to this mother effing list. Welcome back from the break, everybody. I'm joined by Jeff Bergman. We just discussed The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. It is currently in theaters, and we are in the middle of our top seven Samuel L. Jackson roles. We are at number three. Jeff, what do you have?
Well, I'm going back to Tarantino, and I'm going with The Hateful Eight, which is not one of Quentin's favorite, you know, most popular movies, but I feel that it's, you know, he plays a very pivotal character in the movie. He's pretty much in most of it, because it takes place either on the little buggy and then in the house. And he's pretty much, except for some... No, I think he's...
There's a flashback scene where he's not involved.
Yeah. Other than that, he's in the whole movie.
The almost 3-hour long movie. Yeah.
And it's one of these movies where, you know, Quentin does a good job of casting an African-American character of relative... power at, we're talking about it after the Civil War, you know, so I like that. I like when he does that. But yeah, because the movie is, he's in almost every scene. There's a lot of action, drama, dialogue, tons of dialogue. It's probably his most thorough acting performance, I think, of almost anything on this movie, because it's really in most of the movie. So I'm going to go Hateful Eight, number three.
Hateful Eight, length of the movie aside with my issues, Samuel Jackson's great in it. I didn't pick it as my Quentin Tarantino, but rethinking about the movie, because it's also been a while since I've not just like watched entirely, just watched it even in pieces. It's been a while since I watched it, but thinking about he's in almost every scene of this 2-hour, 45-minute movie. I remember some of the...
Oh, what's his character's name?
I don't even remember his character's name. To be fair, it is one of Quentin's less remarkable, less well-known films. We didn't really do as well financially as Django or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which it was sandwiched in between of. But thinking about some of the stuff he does, I remember there's a monologue where he talks to one of the old guys about like his son during the war and like the crude stuff that his son did to Samuel Jackson. I'm thinking like that was a powerful speech. And thinking about it, it was probably Samuel Jackson's best acted out of maybe everything that he's done, thinking about it right now. So I sadly don't have it on my list. I do want to rewatch it. Quentin Tarantino made it into a miniseries on Netflix that I haven't come around on. It's like split up into 40-minute episodes. Maybe I'll rewatch it that way. I don't know, but good pick.
You mean he added, like, extra scenes and stuff?
He added some scenes and then added an intro and credits for each episode. It feels like it's a miniseries.
That's cool.
But like the movie. And I think he used his Roadhouse version, which is like 13 minutes longer or whatever, and made into that miniseries. I really hope, though, that one day he or someone makes a play of The Hateful Eight, because it's a claustrophobic,
right,
pretty much two-set movie that I think could work really well as a play, and I would love that so much. If they got the cast, too, that would be incredible. But only one can dream. Up for me at number three, we are going into the Marvel Universe. We got Nick Fury, and I'm also choosing the Avengers.
Wow!
It's not my favorite. It is a known fact. It's not my favorite Marvel movie, especially with him in. I think that maybe Winter Soldier might be his best movie, but I think that he has the most impact in this one because, as you said, he brings the team together. He eventually motivates the team to avenge, spoilers, Phil Coulson, who dies. But is he really dead? That's a tricky question. But he motivates the team to become the Avengers, to avenge this lost guy. And I think that is a round of applause. And also, he is a badass because he uses a rocket launcher to destroy a plane which has a bomb on it while they're on an aircraft in the middle of the air, pretty much sacrificing himself and the team. It's never dawned upon in the movie, but that was an idea for him. So I think that's pretty cool. $623 million domestically, $1.515 billion worldwide. My number three, Nick Fury in The Avengers.
Good choice.
Thank you. Very original. Who would have picked that?
I don't know. I thought you might have gone Captain Marvel or one of the other ones that, you know, I'm losing track now. All right. My number two, I am going with, and I've talked about this movie before, but I love the movie and I love him in it, and that's Die Hard 3.
Oh, yes.
Which one is that?
Live with Free, a Vengeance.
Die Hard with a Vengeance. You know, we rewatched that a year ago, and, you know, the movie was a little bit before its time in dealing with the whole racial tension between Bruce Willis's character and Samuel L. Jackson's character, but I just thought he was so... I just loved his lines, you know, because he was... playing this like repairman type person, you know, so in his world, he's a responsible, hardworking, blue collar type guy. And then he gets thrown into the Bruce Willis's world. And now he's perceived as being a black man. And so there's some funny banter between the two of them. They make a great team. They really should do another movie together besides, you know, Glass or whatever. But
I never even put that together that they got reunited twice.
Yeah.
From Breakable and Glass.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But they should be in a shoot 'em up. Maybe he'll be added to the next Hitman's Bodyguard's father.
Well, no, because we know who the father is.
Oh, right. Yeah, it can't be.
Hitman's Bodyguard's uncle. Brother?
Uncle? Brother? I don't know. But
that would be fun.
Other than the first Die Hard with a Vengeance is the second, almost as close to the first one, but I love the movie. One of those movies I'll watch on cable when it always comes on.
No, we've talked about this. We watched it back in December, my first time, and like for every movie, whenever Samuel Jackson's in it, of course you perk up. You're like, oh, Samuel Jackson, but the fact that it's early Samuel Jackson and the dynamic with his character in his world and going into Bruce Willis and the way that he's written, not knowing like what's all this stuff, like, it's great. I love it. I didn't pick it for mine because I knew you'd put it on yours, but great choice nonetheless. Up for me at number two, we got a choice that this may not be the number one thing that your generation may be for thinking about for Samuel Jackson, but for the introduction for my generation, the younger generation, the Pixar generation, this was our introduction to Samuel Jackson, and it is his role as Frozone, also known as Lucius Best, in The Incredibles. Now, he doesn't have a big role in the film. He is very much a side character, one may say a minor side character, but he is a superhero with ice powers. He can shoot ice out of his hands, and he gets water to refuel himself. He's cool, he's chill, which is somewhat of a nice pun. He is suave, and he's the awesome best friend to the entire Parr family. He comes in to help Bob when he's trying to like sneak out of the house to not be with his wife, to try to chase crime, or if the city of wherever they live is in danger, he comes out of the blue to help. But why is this on my list? Why has this had such an impact on my generation? Because of the famous super suit scene where he asks his wife, "Honey, where's my super suit?" And she says she put it away. It was funny then. It got a second life on the internet. And they try to redo it in The Incredibles 2. But nothing is as important as Frozone in the first Incredibles. So that is my number two. $261 million domestically. $631 million worldwide. I love it so much.
You know, I have not rewatched The Incredibles since I first saw it, and I've never seen The Incredibles 2. But it was an enjoyable movie, you know. I just don't feel like actors who do, unless you're including Robin Williams in Aladdin.
Yeah.
I don't know if actors in animated roles are memorable enough to make my list.
That's okay, because I was gonna say that's a bias right there. No, it's definitely, you know, generation-wise, it's just, yeah. I've grown up on it, and it has made tons of rounds on Facebook and Twitter. The first film, I rewatched before the second one, and I thought it was right after Infinity War that I rewatched it, and within the whole Marvel Universe craze, watching this superhero movie from, at the time, 14 years ago, like Unbreakable, in a sense, way ahead of its time on the superhero game, better than most Marvel movies. I think it held up really well. Incredibles 2, not the biggest fan of, but that is my number two, The Incredibles. So before we get to number one, what were some Samuel Jackson roles that just didn't make your list?
You know, there's a bunch of movies that I saw. I just don't remember him in it, but I am, you know, like Jungle Fever, Eve's Bayou, Jackie Brown, Time to Kill. He was in all those movies and he had supporting roles in it. And I just don't remember, but I enjoyed the movies at the time. So I just threw him on the list. And of course, I didn't put on Snakes on a Plane. The movie was just so, what's the right word?
Cheeky, out of there.
You know, lowbrow. Not lowbrow, but just
like it knew what it was doing?
Yeah.
For me, I don't know. This was also hard because, as I said, I didn't want to pick multiple Quentin films. So, I mean, as we know, Hateful Eight, he's not on it for that one. I'm still not going to spoil what is my Quentin film choice. As we now can guess, it's my number one. But, you know, other films that just didn't make my list, I mean, as while I don't like his lisp choice, I still think it makes him iconic and memorable in Kingsman. So that's definitely up there. I'm trying to look at his list right now, and it's either stuff I love or stuff that he's barely memorable.
Or like I didn't see Shaft.
Oh, I saw the 2019 Shaft. He was the best part in it, and he's good in it, but the movie's not good, and I don't think, he's great because of that. I saw him in Spiral, the new Saw movie. He's in it. He's one of the best parts in it, but the movie's not good, and because of that, I don't think that he made it any better. He was in Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. To be fair, a forgettable role. That was a Tim Burton movie from 2016 based on the book. I'm trying to look at the list right now. Glass, I wouldn't really say it because I didn't like the movie. I feel like a lot of this might be if I don't like the movie, even though he's great in it, it won't translate well to the list. So, sadly, those films did not make the list. But now it is time for our number one Samuel L. Jackson movie. Unless it's Quentin Tarantino, I can't really recall what your number one may be now.
It's obviously the same, so you might as well just talk about it at the same time.
It's not the same.
What do you mean?
It's not the same.
All right. My number one is Pulp Fiction, is Rose Marcellus in Pulp Fiction, which is his most iconic role. He won various awards for it. He was nominated. He had one of the most famous dialogues in movie history. You know, I don't know how Quentin came up with this line, with these lines. But the thing is, he wasn't in a lot of the movie. There were a lot of the movie that he wasn't in because it was broken up into different stories. But his pairing with John Travolta, legendary. The two of them together, even in the last scene, you know, they're together at the diner. But that is my quintessential
Quentin Tarantino.
Samuel L. Jackson role.
No, 100%. His role in Pulp Fiction is, what you could argue, it is the best. It is the most memorable, definitive. English motherfucker, do you speak it? I mean, I love it. What my friend Benji, I don't know if he listens to this, but back at school, in homeroom, he would recite his speech, the part from the Bible or whatever, and he would do in homeroom because, like, it's so memorable and it's funny, but also Samuel Jackson's great in it. He's offbeat, but he's in the diner. He kind of saves the day. It's also been a long time since I watched the movie.
Right.
The issue why it's not my number one is because I've only seen it once. I saw it late into my Quentin Tarantino game, not that late, but it wasn't my first. What was my most notable first was Django Unchained. So my number one was Samuel Jackson as Stephen Warren in Django Unchained. And why do I like this was kind of the reasons what you're hinting at. He is Calvin Candy's right-hand man. In a sense, he is the top slave. He is the number two in the house. And I think that's such a unique role because, once again, seeing Samuel Jackson in a slave-like role is very unique and different because he is a man of power. And in a typical slave role, you wouldn't have that much power. But because of his positioning in the family or the house, he is a slave with a lot of power. And I think that's awesome and a unique take on this type of character while still being a slave. And I think it's cool, and he's wise, he's smart, he has a badass ending where, once again, Samuel Jackson dies in the movie. But I think this is, once again, another great Tarantino role. As you said, it's Pulp Fiction is probably his best performance of Tarantino's catalog, but this is my definitive Quentin, so it is my definitive Jackson. $162 million domestically, $450 million worldwide. My number one, Stephen Warren in Django Unchained.
Yes, it was a very memorable role. Unfortunately, he did.
He
did kick the bucket at the end.
Or explode in the house.
That's right. Well, he might have survived. You never know. He could have been, you know.
Do you think Quentin Tarantino's last 10th and final film will be Django 2, and it is Samuel Jackson coming back for revenge?
No. I don't know what Quentin's last movie's going to be. I think he's going to go back to, like, a Reservoir Dog sequel.
You think he's going to go small for his final?
Not small. I think he's going to take the characters from Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, like actually do a sequel.
And
based on that, he was...
Include Harvey Keitel was in Pulp Fiction a little bit. He was in, I don't know if it was the same character, but I think he's going to maybe take those, I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do.
Well,
he's living in the Middle East now, so...
Yeah.
He just wrote his book. He might do something that takes place over there. I don't know.
Into that because from memory is only out of United States film was Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
So I don't know. It was actually funny because either today or yesterday in an interview, he said if he would do a Kill Bill 3, which would be his 10th film, he would follow the daughter of Vivica A. Fox. And he, like, in his mind, he casted who would it be. I don't have the actress's name, but he said, if I were to do my Kill Bill 3, which would be my final film, this is who it would be. And I still need to see Kill Bill 2, but I'm down for that. But I would like an original story.
Yeah, I wouldn't want that.
But is he going to go big? What's it going to be? I don't know. I like how we just diverted directly from Samuel Jackson to the Quentin Tarantino episode right here. Would you want Sam to come back?
I want everybody to come back.
Bruce?
I want his
notable cast members.
In
Quentin.
Yeah, I would want him to bring everybody back.
Brad Pitt.
All of them.
Leo.
All of them. Pam Grier.
Which one?
Jackie Brown.
Oh, I haven't seen Jackie. Oh, okay. There's still like half of Quentin's list that I haven't seen.
Oh, okay.
But not Quentin Tarantino. Samuel Jackson. We just went over his filmography. We went over the icon. I'm feeling pretty good about this. I think that we had, while overlapping on maybe two, we still had a pretty diverse list that we got a majority of his good roles.
But you know, I think one day he'll get like an honorary Oscar. You know, at the he'll get like a Lifetime Achievement Award.
He should.
But he hasn't, other than the Pulp Fiction role, he hasn't really had like the real serious role that he'll get nominated for an Academy Award. And maybe he wants to go for that or something and do some type of role that will.
Maybe Quentin can get him that Oscar, once again, an Oscar-nominated or Oscar-winning role. Who knows? Or Samuel Jackson's like, I don't care for the awards at this
point. Maybe the movie's about Marcellus. What happened to him?
Who really wants Quentin's final film to be the Marcellus spinoff?
I would want that.
You're crazy.
He's now, Marcellus is now the head of the, he's like the don of a gangster group. And he like wants to retire and he can't, sort of like Godfather 3. So yeah, that's what I would want.
Well, that is the filmography of Samuel Jackson. And if you're craving for more Samuel Jackson, at the end of the summer, a new Samuel Jackson film is coming out.
Which one?
The Protege. We saw a trailer for it with Maggie Q, Michael Keaton, in front of the Hitman.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't crazy about that one.
Well, it's still coming out. Samuel Jackson, once again, in an action movie. Maybe he just does it for fun, because he just loves doing this stuff. or maybe he's in it for a quick buck.
Well, the great thing about The Hitman's Wife Bodyguard, he got to travel all over Europe because it takes place in many countries in Europe.
That's true. They had a beautiful time in Italy, it looked like.
Yes.
I would want to do that. But once again, that is The Hitman's Wife Bodyguard. Dad, thank you so much for joining me on this episode today. I had a blast talking about the movie, Samuel Jackson, of course. And don't forget, audiences, if you're enjoying the show and you want to hear more, you can actually support the show, Mr. Movie, by going to anchor.fm/Joshua-Bergman/support. You can donate $10, $5, or just $1 a month. Anything would mean so much. Once again, that link is anchor.fm/Joshua-Bergman/support. The link is also in the bio. Jeff, once again, thank you so much. Do you have any lasting words? Any last remarks?
Fucking great show.
What a way to go out. Audiences, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you tune in next time.